This is Defender Radio.
I'm Michael Howie, and this is Defender Radio, the podcast for wildlife advocates and animal lovers, brought to you by the Fur Bearers. 50 years ago this week, Canada officially made beavers one of our national symbols. In celebrating this anniversary and the many ecological services and benefits provided by beavers, the Fur Bearers have a bit of beaver fever. And who better to talk about beavers than Ben Goldfarb, the journalist behind Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. This book has made big waves since it landed in 2018, and today Ben joins Defender Radio to share how he started out writing Eager, what he loves about beavers, his newer works, and how we can look to beavers for hope in uncertain times. But I think to get started, before we get to beavers, what would be really interesting is to learn a bit about how you got into journalism and specifically conservation journalism. Where did that journey start for you?
Well, let's see. As an undergraduate in college, I studied creative writing and environmental science. So I always had those two interests. And then after college, I had a series of kind of field ecology tech jobs working for the National Park Service in Yellowstone and the New York City Parks Department and tagging sea turtles in North Carolina, doing all this cool ecology work. But, you know, along the way, I was also keeping blogs and writing about the experiences I was having. And eventually I realized that I loved the writing about nature and wildlife more than anything else. And that became the full-time gig.
That's really awesome. And it's so great that you were able to do that. What were some of the early things you covered? Was it a very easy transition for you to go, oh, this was a cool thing I did while out working with turtles in North Carolina article? Or was it something where it opened your eyes to a world and you had to start exploring subjects in a new way?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think from the get-go, I was covering wildlife, ecology, conservation, the same stuff I'm writing about now. You know, I was always fascinated by habitat connectivity, you know, the mm-hmm. idea that animals need these large, intact landscapes through which to wander. So one of my really formative journalistic experiences, right when I decided to take the leap and write full time, was I got a grant to travel the entirety of the Yellowstone to Yukon wildlife corridor, yep. starting from the Yukon and going south to Yellowstone National Park. So my then girlfriend, now wife, and I made that trip over a couple of months, and I was interviewing sources along the way, and of course, you know, seeing lots of incredible wildlife and that experience and the opportunity to drive through and hike through some of the kind of the wildest, most intact ecosystems in North America. That was a really profound, formative experience that really still influences what I cover today.
I imagine so. That's it's an incredible conservation program, the Y2K, which is funny to say now. It's not Y2K. It's Yukon to Yellowstone. Why do I? Yeah. Y2K was something else. Yeah.
yeah. Well, a little anticlimactic. Yeah.
I do remember that night very clearly and thinking, now it's over. And then here we are sometime later. And I guess that's when things started to open up for you. You were being published in great magazines. I mean, Smithsonian Magazine to me would be the pinnacle of it all. But getting out there and writing about these things, and then comes Eager. This is a book that put you on a lot of people's radars, really moved you up, I think, in the echelon of writing and publications.
Oh, geez.
it's a great book that has opened a lot of people's eyes to a very important subject. And it's a good read. I think that's the other thing people really loved about it, is it's not just an informative book. It's good. It's fun to read. And it's one you can pick up, put down, and just always feel like you're walking away with something, which is an awesome kind of book, in my opinion. But could we talk a bit about how you got there? Again, is this part of the journey from Yukon to Yellowstone? Was this something you had seen along the way, learning about beavers? Or was it something that you chose to look at very specifically?
Yeah, well, and thanks for saying all that nice stuff about Eager, Mike. I really appreciate it, especially coming from somebody as beaver knowledgeable as you. I think, for me, you know, look, I always loved beavers. You know, I mean, as a kid, you know, I grew up in New York and spent a lot of time hiking and camping and fishing in the Catskills, the Adirondacks, you know, some of the more beavery places in the northeastern U.S. You know, I have this early childhood memory of being on a lake in the Adirondacks with my parents after dark and, you know, hearing the classic gunshot of the tail slap next to the canoe and, you know, practically capsizing the canoe. We were so startled. So, you know, I always liked beavers and cared about them. But, you know, the true kind of conversion story, you know, for me, that happened, you know, maybe a year or so after that Why Do I trip. I was, you know, again, early in my career as a journalist, I was working at the time for a magazine called High Country News, which covers environmental issues throughout the American West. I was living in Seattle, and somebody sent me this flyer for a beaver workshop that was happening just outside the city. And, you know, I had no idea what a beaver workshop was or what that entailed. But, you know, you're a journalist, right? You sort of have this instinct for what might be a story. It sounded like it could be a cool story. So I went to this beaver workshop, and it was just, you know, one scientist after another getting up to say their piece about why beavers were so important for all of the reasons that, you know, listeners of this podcast understand, you know, their water storage abilities and their salmon habitat creation and wildfire mitigation and water quality. And, you know, you run down the list. And for me, that was just this incredibly eye-opening experience where I realized that, hey, you know, this animal that I had grown up liking and caring about wasn't just, you know, a cool, fun, interesting rodent. It was really one of the primary architects of the North American landscape and also one of the most important ecological tools in our toolbox, not to reduce, you know, a wild animal with agency to a tool, but, yeah. You know, they're valuable partners in restoration, as, you know, as we all know. And so it was that workshop that just, you know, totally radicalized me. And so I ended up writing a few articles that came out of that workshop. I, you know, spent a lot of time with some of the beaver restoration folks, you know, working in Washington State, like the Metow Valley Beaver Project up in Winthrop, Washington. You know, got to see some beavers being relocated. That was a great experience. And so, and then over the next, you know, few years, those articles basically turned into Eager, the book.
It's always interesting how those stories come together to me, because I talk with some people where it's I decided I wanted to write this book, and then I just threw myself into research.
Yeah.
But I find a lot of the time with nature journalism or naturalist writing, it is very much I'd already written half the book when I decided to write the book effectively, which right. is kind of the impression I'm getting from you of there was a lot of stuff already. You'd gained a lot of knowledge. You'd already done a lot of interviews and learned a lot. And then it was sort of putting it together, I guess, more than actually deciding to do it, to get from zero to finished.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, also just figuring out the different geographies in which people were working on beavers. You know, I mean, I think that's one of the incredible things about these animals, right? Of that they're, you know, they're doing basically the same thing everywhere, you know, you find them, right? They're, of course, building dams and creating ponds and wetlands. But, you know, how those ponds and wetlands affect the landscape and why we care about those ponds and wetlands is different depending on what geography you're in, right? So in Washington, where I was living when I started this process, you know, salmon was kind of the primary motivator for, yep. for people caring about beavers, because of course beavers create incredible salmon habitat. You know, in this kind of the arid intermountain West, you know, it was drought mitigation and water storage. You know, I went to England and Scotland, where people cared primarily about flood control, you know, these rainy places that are getting wetter with climate change. You know, in Nevada, it's safe. Sage grouse, you know, in North Carolina, it's rare butterflies that beaver wetlands are supporting, right? So that was, you know, to me, when I said, okay, I'm going to go from, you know, writing these articles about beavers in the state of Washington and salmon habitat to, okay, now I'm going to write an entire book about beavers. You know, that was sort of the first step for me, was figuring out the different geographies in which people were working on these animals and, you know, why they're so important wherever you are and how those kind of regional values and ecological connections differ.
The regional values is a fascinating subject too, that I've read a bit about in the horticulture world, where I'm doing some classwork, and how depending on where you are, cultural expectations, even within a single city, can change from one side of the city to the other. Right. And it's interesting to apply that to something like people's perception of beavers, that it would have such regional cultural differences in that way. Was that something that was surprising to you to really encounter and see, like, it's the same animal, the biology is the same. These, as again, they are very individual critters, but beavers are not different, that different, I guess, across the North American landscape, but you have all of these different attitudes. Did that come as a surprise to you?
Yeah, you know, it did. And I think that what was interesting was writing about beavers in a United States context in which people aren't as beaver savvy as I think, you know, your Canadian peers are, right? I mean, I know that, you know, you've had Francis Backhouse, on the podcast. Yep. And Michael Rentz. And, you know, I mean, when I conceptualized Eager, you know, there were some great books out there about beavers already, right? But they were kind of Canadian books. And obviously, yeah, you know, the U.S. certainly appears in Once They Were Hats. But, you know, it is a kind of a Canada-centric book. And I think that reflects the kind of the differential understanding of how important these animals are in our two countries, right? I mean, I think that, you know, in Canada, of course, you know, beavers are on your currency, right? There's so much, yep, they're this kind of national mammal. You know, there's so much iconography around beavers. Whereas, you know, in the US, you know, I think there's a lot of comparative beaver ignorance. You know, I don't think people recognize these animals as being historically incredibly abundant, but, you know, there were so many amazingly iconic American beaver stories. You know, the story of the American Revolution, you know, is partly the story of the fur trade, because, you know, one of the British offenses that angered the colonists was denying them access to trapping grounds west of the Appalachians, right? I mean, you know, Lewis and Clark describe seeing beavers in every tributary going up the Missouri River during the Corps of Discovery. You know, the Louisiana Purchase, right? I mean, that was, you know, Jefferson partly trying to secure new areas to trap beavers, right? So, you know, I think there's this understanding, there's that, you know, the great Margaret Atwood quote, which I'm paraphrasing, that, you know, that Canada was built on the backs of dead beavers or something like that. But, yeah, you know, you could say the same thing about the United States, right? And I think that, you know, that most Americans don't realize that the way that Canadians realize it. And so I think that, you know, that was one of the things I was trying to do as well, was say, okay, you know, we know, thanks to Francis and Michael and others, that, you know, the beavers are this iconic Canadian animal. You know, what's their role in American landscapes as well? They sound like beavers, you know, stop at the border.
Yeah. Well, these days they might. But that's right, get into, yeah, the politics of it. So I am
not
curious. This came out in 2018, Eager, Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. And we're now 2025. From your perspective, from when the book came out and first started hitting stores and you first started seeing reviews to today, would you say there is a better or changing understanding of beavers in American culture, or even in some of the more particular or the more specific areas, like in municipal planning and roads and works? And we'll get into your next book as well, talking about roads and works. Have you seen a shift over those several years?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's been a dramatic tectonic shift, you know, in American attitudes towards beavers. And, you know, I think that Eager probably added a stick to the dam. But, you know, I mean, there's just so many different organizations and people and groups working on beavers over the last decade that have helped to you know, move the ball. I mean, I think about you know, the I mean, look, one of the great examples of that is California, right? Which is, you know, sort of the, yeah, I think the best example of beaver progress in the country, probably. You know, when I wrote Eager, the chapter about California was how backwards California was, right? I mean, California was this state that actually didn't even acknowledge until very recently that beavers were native to most of the state. They basically managed them as a non-native species, which is, you know, completely backwards, as, you know, many fantastic scientists and advocates proved by, you know, reviewing the historical evidence. But, you know, again, the chapter in Eager about California is basically, you know, here's this state that needs beavers more than any place in the country, probably, and treats them as hostile, yep, you know, because they have this historical misconception about where beavers belong. You know, fast forward to 2025, you know, California is one of the most pro beaver places on earth. You know, the state has a fantastic beaver program, and, you know, Gavin Newsom is a beaver fan, and this, you know, they did their first relocation a couple of years ago. And, you know, that's a testament to the hard work of lots of people, you know, the Bring Back the Beaver campaign out of the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center with, you know, Kate Lundquist and Brock Dolman, who are just incredible beaver champions. Of course, Heidi Perryman, you know, a famous person in the beaver mm-hmm. world from Martinez, California, who advocated for these animals. So, you know, there's just this incredible groundswell of beaver support that has just completely changed the story for these critters. You know, I think about the Beaver Believers, you know, the fantastic documentary by Sarah yep. Koenigsberg, you know, all the work that Emily Fairfax has done on the beaver wildfire connection. You know, I think, you know, maybe more than any other sort of beaver connection. I mean, it's Emily's firework that's, you know, yep. that's kind of gotten attention and moved beavers forward, because of course fire is an issue on the top of everyone's mind mm-hmm. in the American West. So yeah, I think the outlook for beavers has you know definitely changed, and that's you know, that's all of course incredibly exciting.
It is. It's great to see the evolution of it happening, and I think relatively quickly, all things considered, these days.
Oh, it's dramatic. Yeah, it's incredible how rapid it is.
Yeah, I think it's as soon as people kind of realize, oh, not only do beavers just do this work that makes the landscape better in most ways, yeah. But we don't have to do anything about it. I think that's the big thing that I hear people sort of surprised about is, oh, well, we have to bring a beaver here and put it there. They have to be, and like, we have to manage them very particularly. And when they realize, it's kind of a no, the beavers are going to go where there's not enough water, but a little bit of water. Do their thing, and then you have water. And if there are infrastructure challenges, there are non-lethal, humane solutions that allow the beavers generally to remain in place while protecting the infrastructure. And they go, oh, why aren't we doing that? And I think that's kind of the question of the day at times is, well, why aren't we just letting beavers back onto the landscape and allowing them to do their thing? I try and at times across Canada, wherever I am, try and envision the area as it was several hundred years ago before yeah. we nearly wiped out beavers, and recognize like this Walmart was probably home to 20 beavers and this thriving ecosystem that they generated and maintained, and all of the different species of flora and fauna that are interdependent upon this beaver pond being here. And it's at one hand overwhelming and another hand really exciting. Do you think there is still resistance because it is a historic idea, the idea that beavers did have a lot of dominion over North America's landscape? Then we effectively killed most of them off. And now the numbers are, I mean, the numbers have recovered to a point that we don't need to worry about beavers, but it's still nowhere near where it was. I think it was something insane, like 330 million beavers, something like that.
I think an order of magnitude more than that. Yeah, I think hundreds yeah. of millions of beavers is a pretty safe assumption.
Yeah, so it's been a seismic shift. It's not back, and it probably will never be back to where it was. Right. But do you think that historic mindset of, oh, well, they're a problem that we have to deal with, is a significant issue in terms of moving people forward?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think there are two issues that go hand in hand with that. I mean, first is you know what you're alluding to, which is just we don't really understand how profoundly abundant these animals were, right? I mean, when we trapped out several hundred million beavers, you know, we changed landscapes in ways that we don't totally recognize, right? I mean, I read about this in Eager. Of course, Francis writes about this in Once They Were Hats. You know, the idea that you took all of these incredible beaver pond and wetland complexes, you know, killed the animals, the dams broke down, and, you know, those wetlands dried up and the streams degraded into single thread channels. And so you go from this incredibly lush, blue, green, wet, you know, beaver filled valley bottom to, a narrow meandering stream moving through a dry valley. I think the issue is that we don't realize when we look at that meandering single thread stream through a dry valley, we don't necessarily recognize that that's wrong, right? Because, you know, we all grew up, I love to fly fish, you know, and I fly fish in those sorts of places, right? You can catch plenty of trout, you know, in a meandering single thread channel. And so it feels healthy, but, you know, then you think about what the historical baselines were and you look at systems in which beavers have recovered and you realize, oh yeah, you know, there should be ponds and wetlands all over this valley bottom. You know, it shouldn't just be a single narrow threaded channel. you know, it should be this incredible wetland complex. And so, you know, in some ways, I think if we're going to embrace beavers, you know, we have to reconfigure our historical imaginations and think differently about what our ecosystems and landscapes are supposed to look like. So I think that's one challenge. And then the other challenge that you alluded to is the coexistence challenge, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that beavers and humans are both fanatical micromanagers of the natural world, right? We both love, arranging the landscape to maximize our food and shelter. The problem is that we do it in very different ways, right? We, you know, we like everything neat and tidy. We like our, you know, our roads and our railroads and our irrigation ditches. We like linear infrastructure, right? Whereas beavers create what looks to us like a mess. You know, there are ponds and dams and wetlands everywhere, and there are dead and dying trees all over the place and little sharpened sticks poking out of the ground. And the bottom of the pond is all sediment and mucky. And so, you know, we just have this kind of divergent vision with them about, you know, how these systems should work. And of course, you know, we modify systems, aquatic systems, in ways that are fundamentally negative to the vast majority of biological life. And beavers do it in a way that's positive to the vast majority of biological life. So, I do think that there's this humility that we need to adopt and to recognize that, hey, you know, if we're going to solve a lot of our ecological challenges, you know, we need to turn over the management of our landscapes to these, you know, these rodents who were here longer and do it better than we do.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great tie-in to talking about road ecology and your more recent book, Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. This is a subject I personally have found so interesting to read about and experience. I was very fortunate to interview some folks out of Parks Canada Banff, where they've actually done the long-term monitoring of wildlife crossings and stuff. Cool. And they love that work, obviously. And it's saving lives and saving millions of dollars in insurance premiums. Right. But I thought briefly, could you share a bit about sort of the idea of road ecology, wildlife, and why it's something we need to be talking about these days?
Absolutely. Yeah. So road ecology is basically this relatively small but fast growing field of science. It looks at all of the different connections between our transportation infrastructure and the natural world, right? And, you know, it really starts with roadkill. You know, we've all seen the dead deer, elk by the side of the highway. And, you know, certainly a lot of road ecology is about, you know, how to prevent roadkill through the use of fences and wildlife crossings like they did in Banff. And, you know, a lot of the book is about the design of those wildlife crossings. You know, where do you put them? What species do they work for? Or how do you optimize them for different species? You know, how do we know they work? And they certainly do work really well. But, you know, road ecology is, you know, it is this kind of larger field. And so there's, you know, it's not just the wildlife crossings and fences. You know, also in the book I write about, you know, road noise and its impacts on songbird migrations and human health. You know, road salt is this tremendous polluter of aquatic ecosystems that we, you know, put down tens of millions of pounds of it every year as a de-icing agent without, you know, much understanding of, you know, how dramatically it's changing our aquatic systems. You know, you've got the impacts of roads on human societies. You know, the fact that urban freeways in the U.S. and in Canada are sort of barriers to the movement of humans on foot and you know, create these really segregated cities in many places. So road ecology is again, it's this, you know, this field of science that looks at all of those different relationships and connections and figures out, you know, what to do about them, how to solve some of the problems that roads create for nature.
And did you come across any particularly unique or exciting solutions? Because again, I think it's very easy for all of us to point out the problems around us. It's a skill that as humans we are very well versed in, but finding answers, celebrating them, and then trying, experimenting with them is something we need to maybe focus on more. So were there any that stood out to you in that process of writing Crossings, or that you've learned about since writing it that are of particular excitement to you?
Yeah, you know, I really love the chapter of the book about a really famous wildlife crossing that's under construction right now for mountain lions just outside of Los Angeles. This is the Liberty Canyon Wildlife Crossing or the Wallace Annenberg Wildlife Crossing. And this is built for this little population of mountain lions who live just outside of LA, some of the most urban large carnivores on Earth. And, you know, these are kind of the poster animals for the impacts of highways on wildlife. You know, these mountain lions are basically trapped in this little island of habitat in the Santa Monica Mountains, surrounded by this ocean of freeways and development. And, you know, because these mountain lions can't cross the big, busy freeways, you know, they can't mingle and mate with mountain lions elsewhere in California. They're stuck on their little island. And as a result, they, you know, they've been forced to reproduce with their own relatives, and they've become very, very inbred over time. They're suffering genetic defects, and we're at risk of losing these animals, if nothing is done for them. But, you know, fortunately something is being done for them. This gigantic, wildlife crossing is under construction right now. It should be done, sometime, hopefully in early 2026 is the last that I heard. It's basically this huge bridge that's going to cross or is crossing the 101 freeway, the busiest freeway on Earth, 10 lanes of traffic, hundreds of thousands of cars per day. And it'll let mountain lions, as well as bobcats and deer and all kinds of other critters, go back and forth and reproduce and, you know, hopefully heal some of those genetic divides, that fragmentation that the freeway has imposed. And I just think that's such a cool project because it's really changing the what's possible for wildlife crossings. You know, I mean, if you can build a wildlife crossing, you know, close to Los Angeles over the busiest freeway on Earth, you can build one anywhere. You know, I mean, a couple of years ago, I was here in Colorado. I was out with some biologists who've been trying to get a wildlife crossing built over Interstate 70, you know, the big four lane freeway that that runs through Colorado and cuts off elk and lynx migrations, among other animals, and they said, look, I mean, historically it seemed impossible that we could build a wildlife crossing over I-70, but you know, now, hey, they're doing it in LA, we can do it here, right? So that, you know, expanding the sense of possibility and the scope of places that are appropriate for this, you know, this wildlife friendly infrastructure, I just find that so inspiring.
That's very cool. I'd like to talk a little bit about environmental journalism or conservation journalism. I get asked a lot about journalism, wildlife, and so on. I've done webinars on media sensationalism specific to coyotes and a lot of subject matter like that. And people say, well, why aren't we getting good journalism anymore about wildlife? And I mean, the quick answer is because we're firing all the journalists.
and the editors.
Yeah, so. That too, yes. It's very simple. Good. That is why. But I think it also leads to the bigger question of why is it so important to have science-educated journalists or journalists who are capable of writing accessibly about science in today's world? I'm curious for your thoughts on that, the importance of natural journalism, conservation journalism, science communication, and so on.
Yeah, wow, that's such a great question, Mike. And it's so the importance of science journalism and environmental journalism. It's so fundamental to, you know, who I am and the work I do. It's almost hard to know, you know, where to begin answering that question because I believe so passionately in the importance of conservation and of biodiversity and look, I mean, conservation problems are fundamentally public facing problems, right? I mean, you know, you know this from your work on coyotes that if we're going to, you know, the coyotes and beavers and ravens and prairie dogs, I mean, all, you know, there's so many species that are basically animals that we have historically wiped out in large part because, you know, we are hostile to them. And that's because we don't really understand them very well, you know, and I certainly believe that, you know, understanding these animals is sort of fundamental to stewarding them properly. You know, I mean, I think about coyotes, you know, and I've written a lot about coyotes and coyote management, an animal that's very similar to beavers and, you know, in how we perceive it, I think, and in how many we kill, unfortunately. And, you know, I mean, there's an animal that, we know is so sort of fundamental to regulating ecosystems. You know, it's a top predator in many urban systems in North America. It's, you know, profoundly important. Lots of great research about, you know, coyotes controlling feral cats, you know, and therefore improving songbird populations, you know, through trophic cascades. And so, you know, but that's another animal that we vilify because we don't, you know, we don't fully recognize its importance. In my own experience, you know, some of the most gratifying moments of my life have been hearing from, you know, state wildlife departments, you know, in the U.S. saying, hey, you know, we read your book and we're changing our beaver management policies. Or, you know, I've had ranchers come up to me after talks and say, hey, you know, I read your book. I stopped killing the beavers in my irrigation ditches. I bought copies for my buddies. They stopped killing their beavers. Like, wow, what a cool moment. So, you know, at the core of my being, you know, I believe that environmental journalism can, you know, change people's minds, and through changing minds, ultimately change policy and management.
Amazing. And that actually ties into sort of where I'd like to wrap up, because we're in an era right now with a lot of uncertainty. Environmental issues that were forefront in media coverage, in elections just several years ago, are now background noise at times. And I'm wondering if you have a way where you find hope for moving forward, if there is something you look to when it's, you know, you make the mistake of putting on television news at 11 o'clock and just go, ugh. Is there something for you that helps you stay the course and continue pushing forward in this important work?
Yeah, boy, that's a really good question, Mike. I mean, it is hard to feel hopeful at times, especially right now. You know, you think about, of course, the Trump administration's dismantling of, you know, of every important land management and wildlife agency in the U.S. and the consequences that's going to have for conservation. It's catastrophic, and it's hard to remain hopeful when you feel like you know, some vandals are basically dismantling everything that you care about and love. But you know, I mean, I do think that one of the reasons that beavers are a hopeful subject is that, you know, they're animals that can thrive without a lot of federal involvement, right? And by that, I mean that, you know, the units of government that control the fate of beavers tend to be pretty local ones, right? I mean, I think about, you know, our community here in Colorado. You know, historically, our county road and bridge department had an informal beaver bounty. You know, they'd kill the beavers that you know, were that they found in culverts on county roads. And you know, that now that bounty no longer exists. And you know, we're talking about how to, you know, move to the kind of non-lethal culvert protection work that you know, the Beaver Institute does, and I'm sure you and Adam Burnett talked about.
Yep.
You know, it's so you know, it's town councils, it's county road crews, it's, of course, you know, individual landowners, you know, farmers and ranchers, right? I mean, if we can influence those people and those local levels of government, then, you know, beavers are going to be okay, right? I mean, yes, there's a, you know, there's a federal role to play, and it's sad to watch, you know, land management agencies like the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management, you know, dismantle their restoration programs. That's certainly not good for beavers. But, you know, ultimately, these are animals that, you know, we can just convince local governments to stop killing them. You know, we can really do a lot of good and make a lot of progress. And we can do that, you know, whether the Trump administration is burning everything to the ground or not. And so, you know, that notion of beavers is this hyper local issue that we can influence no matter who the president is. You know, I find hope in that.
Awesome. And then to totally wrap up, last question. I think it's we talked a bit about journalism. We talked a bit about the conservation journalism and how you got into it. What advice do you have for others who are interested in doing what you do, or want to get into the process of trying to write or trying to be a conservation reporter, or again, even just a journaler as opposed to a journalist? Do you have tips that you would offer people to help them maybe get going in writing about local things?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, look, this is you know, in kind of facile, obvious advice, but, you know, before you can be a writer, you have to be a prolific reader. You know, and I mean, my book certainly would not exist without the books of David Quammen and Elizabeth Colbert and John McPhee. I mean, all of the writers who I so admire and, you know, and you know, consciously and unconsciously emulate in my style. And of course, all of the magazine work that I've read over the years, and National Geographic and Harper's and The New Yorker, you know, I mean, name every great magazine in, you know, in North America. And, you know, I think that's, you know, that's really where you began, right, is by reading prolifically. And, you know, one great piece of advice that I got very early in my career from a really terrific environmental journalist named Jonathan Thompson was that, you know, every time you read a story and are left with a question, the answer to that question is itself potentially a story, right? Yeah. And I think that's especially true when you think about, you know, sort of the local journalism. You know, you could maybe you read a big new you know, Environmental Protection Agency report about water quality in the US or whatever the equivalent of that is in Canada, and the question you're left with is okay, how does that, you know, what does that say about my community?
Yeah.
You know, or you know, how can I figure out you know, what the local implications are there. So yeah, if you read a story, you're left with the question. Answering that question, that's a story. And I think that's guided a lot of my journalism. I mean, here's, you know, one example of that, just because we're talking about, you know, animals that are perceived as nuisance animals. You know, I remember early in my career, I read this very short item in some newspaper in Nevada about how, you know, a county commission had just declared ravens an official nuisance species in the county. And I was like, why would ravens be a nuisance? And, you know, and what does that mean? And what are the implications there? And, you know, and answering that question ended up, you know, being this very long feature about, you know, about raven intelligence and how they've flourished because of anthropogenic subsidies and, you know, and what it means to manage them properly and so on. And it just took me down this really wonderful rabbit hole. So, you know, read a story, answer the questions you're left with, and, you know, you'll find plenty of stories that way.
I want to thank Ben for joining me on such short notice to get this episode out during our Beaver Week celebrations. You can learn more about Ben, his books Eager and Crossings, and more of his writings on his website at bengoldfarb.com. You can also find links in this week's show notes. Eager and Crossings are available in your local bookstore or library or via bengoldfarb.com. I also want to thank you for joining us today and choosing to celebrate Castor Canadensis along with us at the Fur Bearers. Remember to hit subscribe or follow wherever you listen to Defender Radio to get notified of new episodes as they drop. Until next time, I'm Michael Howie for Defender Radio and the Fur Bearers, reminding you to stay informed and stay strong.